content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we have another one of our double issues this week. It's the August 17th, August 24, 2018 issue of The Week magazine. So we'll spend two programs reading through it. And the cover drawing this week shows a woman standing at the voting booth. She's got her finger poised like she's about to press the button. And then she's got a startled look on her face. She's startled because over her left shoulder, right behind her, is a smiling Vladimir Putin in his typical suit. But he's got three different I voted buttons on his lapel. And the title is Back for More: How Russia Could Interfere in the 2018 elections. And I think we'll pick that up a couple of times. So since we've got 2 weeks to go through this magazine, we will go through all we have on the main stories pages. There's one long one and two short ones. The first is Trump admits his son sought Russia's help. What happened? President Trump has once again altered the narrative of his son Donald Jr.'s meeting with a Russian lawyer at Trump Tower during the 2016 campaign, with the president explicitly admitting that the purpose was to collect damaging information on Hillary Clinton. This was a meeting to get information on an opponent, totally legal and done all the time in politics, and it went nowhere, the president tweeted Sunday. The admission directly contradicted a July 2017 statement attributed to Donald Jr., but later confirmed to have been dictated by the president, that said the meeting was primarily about adoptions of Russian children. Federal law prohibits campaigns from accepting a thing of value from foreign nationals. The president continued to maintain he had no prior knowledge of the meeting and that the Russians provided no information on Clinton. Trump's legal team this week sent a counteroffer to Special Counsel Robert Mueller's proposed terms for interviewing the president for the investigation into Russia's interference in the 2016 election. The White House is insisting that questions be narrowly limited to potential collusion with Russia and not related to whether Trump obstructed justice in trying to impede the investigation through various actions and statements, including firing FBI Director James Comey. Rudy Giuliani, the president's lead attorney, said Mueller should not be permitted to ask questions that are, quote, perjury traps. What the editorial said: it's tough to keep up with Trump's contradictions, said the San Francisco Chronicle. His no collusion mantra has given way to colluding with Russia would not be against the law, while paradoxically arguing that he is innocent of this supposed non-crime. Trump maintains that he has nothing to fear from the truth, yet his brazen efforts to abort Mueller's investigation portray a president working very hard to obscure it. Trump has lied to the country for 13 months, said the Newark, New Jersey Star-Ledger, and his admission is a turning point of his struggle to contain the Russia scandal. Trump's former lawyer, Michael Cohen, reportedly is willing to testify that Trump approved of the planned meeting before it took place, which is hardly surprising. His son set it up after being explicitly promised sensitive information as part of the Russian government's support for Mr. Trump. As the truth seeps out, Trump's facade of deniability is starting to crumble. What the columnist said: Trump's strategy to delegitimize Mueller's investigation isn't new, said Andrew McCarthy in NationalReview.com. It's the same scandalize the prosecutor tactic deployed by Bill Clinton in the 1990s against independent counsel Ken Starr. Unsurprisingly, the media Democrat complex that aided and abetted Clinton's public relations campaign today clutches its pearls in anguish, while Trump and Giuliani successfully erode public confidence in Mueller's investigation by portraying it as partisan. Trump has real reason to fear impeachment, which is why he has sought to turn public opinion, the thing that moves Congress, against the investigation. Trump's desperate behavior is more Nixonian than Clintonian, said former Deputy Attorney General William Ruckelshaus in the WashingtonPost.com. Knowing he incriminated himself on Oval Office tape recordings, Richard Nixon fired Watergate Special Prosecutor Archibald Cox, triggering a constitutional crisis that led to his resignation. Trump is somehow conducting himself more frantically than Nixon, demanding Mueller's investigation be shut down while protesting his innocence. As in Watergate, the rule of law is at stake. Soliciting Russia's help to influence an election is worse than a scandal, said Cass Sunstein in Bloomberg.com. It is a betrayal. The Russian government was working to weaken, undermine, and destabilize our country. And no candidate or campaign should even consider accepting its offer of dirt on an opponent. The highest loyalty of any candidate and any president is to his nation, not to electoral victory. Trump's lawyers have good reason to fear their client being interviewed by Mueller's team, said Greg Sargent in WashingtonPost.com. It would be dangerous for him to lie about efforts to scuttle the investigation because there are witnesses and ample evidence that will contradict him. On the other hand, Trump might tell the truth, which could be even more incriminating. To establish obstruction, prosecutors will seek evidence of corrupt intent, and in Trump's impulsive tweets, TV interviews, and actions, he's provided a mountain of it. And we'll take two more stories on the main stories page. Manafort's right-hand man turns on him. What happened? Rick Gates, the star prosecution witness in the tax and fraud trial of former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort, testified this week that he committed numerous crimes at the direction of his former business partner, while defense attorneys sought to paint Gates as a habitual liar who swindled Manafort. Gates, who served as the veteran Republican operative's deputy for more than a decade, described how he worked with Manafort in Ukraine to help elect a Russian-aligned president in 2010, work for which Manafort was paid tens of millions of dollars by Ukrainian oligarchs. To dodge U.S. taxes, Gates said those payments flowed through shell companies and bank accounts in Cyprus, which were tapped to support Manafort's luxurious lifestyle in the U.S. When the money ran out, Gates said, Manafort lied to banks to secure loans and once personally edited a profit and loss statement to show his firm had $3 million in profit instead of more than $600,000 in losses. Manafort's defense team attacked Gates as not credible, noting that he had admitted to embezzling hundreds of thousands of dollars from Manafort, some of which was used to finance a transatlantic extramarital affair. Gates admitted it was also possible that he had stolen funds from Trump's inaugural committee, on which he'd served as deputy chairman. After all the lies you've told, said defense attorney Kevin Downing, you expect this jury to believe you? Gates, who pleaded guilty and agreed to cooperate with special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation, said he did. I'm trying to change, he explained. What the columnist said. Americans might hear all this and think, so what, said Franklin Foer in TheAtlantic.com. On its face, the Manafort trial has little to do with Trump, let alone Russian collusion. but it has exposed how Manafort's corruption infected Trump's presidential campaign. According to Mueller's prosecutors, Manafort promised a campaign job to a Chicago banker in exchange for $16 million in loans. The banker ended up as one of Trump campaign's 13 official economic advisors. Was that really the only quid pro quo deal struck by Manafort? Much of the prosecution's case has amounted to rich equals guilty, said David Warrington in TheHill.com. They wasted hours describing how Manafort blew $15,000 on a custom-made ostrich jacket and $21,000 on a watch. But his spending habits have nothing to do with tax avoidance. Mueller's team is simply trying to exploit juries' natural prejudice against the wealthy and the assumption that if you have a fat wallet, you must have committed a crime. Manafort could face life in prison if found guilty, so he deserves a fair trial on the actual charges. This trial must be agony for Trump, said Jennifer Rubin in WashingtonPost.com. His witch hunt argument, no crimes, nothing to see, is evaporating as we discover exactly why prosecutors have been going after his cronies. And worse is yet to come. Manafort will go on trial again later this year, unless he strikes a deal for failing to register as a foreign agent for a Russian-backed Ukrainian party. That's when we'll hear plenty about Russia. A warning on election interference. What happened? Confirming that Russia is still targeting American elections, the Trump administration this week sought to reassure the public that it is working to defend against foreign interference. Making a rare appearance in the White House briefing room, the nation's top intelligence officials described a 24/7, 365 days a year campaign to influence the 2018 midterm elections and beyond. Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen told reporters that, in addition to spreading misinformation on social media, the Russians have shown a willingness and a capability to hack into election infrastructure such as voter rolls and voting machines. Our democracy is in the crosshairs, Nielsen said. The briefing came several days after President Trump held his first ever National Security Council meeting dedicated to election security. Afterwards, the White House released a statement saying that the administration will not tolerate foreign interference in our elections, but didn't issue any new policy directives. Despite his officials' insistence that election security is a top priority, Trump himself continued to cast doubt on the idea that Russians have interfered in U.S. elections. We are being hindered by the Russian hoax, Trump said at a rally in Wilkes Barre, Pennsylvania, just hours after the briefing room update on election security. It's a hoax, okay? What the columnist said, President Trump's election security push is a sham, said Max Boot in the Washington Post. With fewer than 100 days to go until the midterms, Trump held a, quote, pro forma meeting that lasted less than an hour and resulted in zero concrete action. Meanwhile, he continues to undercut the dire warnings of his intelligence experts. It doesn't matter if Trump's deputies are doing their level best to protect the country if they don't have presidential support. At this point, it's hard to avoid the suspicion that Trump is perfectly happy that no one is minding the store. We know we would be delusional to expect Trump to defend U.S. democracy, said Frieda Giddes in CNN.com. He sees any discussion of Russian election interference as delegitimizing his victory in 2016. But what about congressional Republicans? Why aren't they responding with the urgency this crisis demands? Last week, Senate Republicans voted down a bill that would have provided $250 million in additional funding for election security before midterms. House Republicans blocked a similar bill last month. Maybe they're simply afraid of upsetting Trump, but perhaps they are hoping to benefit from Moscow's work. The real threat from Russia isn't election hacking, said Betsy McCaffey in the New York Post. Russian hackers infiltrated over 100 electrical utilities in the U.S. last year, according to the Department of Homeland Security. In some cases, the attackers would have been able to shut down power delivery if they'd wanted to. Washington remains obsessed with election meddling, but if Russia launched a major cyber attack on our electrical grid, we'd have no lights, no gas at the pump, no life support in hospitals, no mass transit, no food supply. Why isn't that getting more attention than Russian internet trolls? Controversy of the week. Sarah Young, does anti-white racism exist? Did the New York Times just hire a racist to help write its editorials? To anyone not steeped in the left's new religion of social constructionism, said Andrew Sullivan in nymag.com, the answer is obviously yes. Last week, the Times added Korean-American tech writer Sarah Young, 30, to its editorial board, apparently in the full knowledge that Young has for years been spewing racial hatred against white people on Twitter. "White men are bull blank," reads one tweet. "Blank white women" is another. She went further with hashtag cancel white people, and by sneering that pale skin makes white people only fit to live underground, like groveling goblins. Replace the word white with black or Jewish, needless to say, and Young would be fired in a heartbeat. Instead, the Times is defending her, insisting that her anti-white tweets, which she now says she regrets, were merely imitating the rhetoric of white racists who viciously harassed her online. "What nonsense," said Jason Riley in the Wall Street Journal. The Times' liberal editors evidently share the woke progressive view that only minorities can be the victims of racism, never white people. Indeed, since the Times hired Young to help formulate and express the official position of the newspaper, it's clear they like where she's coming from. To confuse Young's tweets with actual racism is ridiculous, said Zach Bocamp in Vox.com. When a person of color tweets out hashtag cancel white people, it's obviously satire, not a threat. Whites still remain firmly in control of the underlying power structure in American society, which means that the prospect of concentration camps for white people is laughable. When a white person tweets hashtag cancel black people, conversely, it carries a real sense of threat, because there is a percentage of this country's white majority that really would welcome the mass imprisonment and deportation of black and brown people. And as we have seen, wields the power to make it happen. Arguing that a young woman deserves another chance is one thing, said Yaka Monk in Slate.com. But do liberals really want to defend and even celebrate Young's angry rhetoric? In flinging racial vitriol back at Twitter trolls, she gave Donald Trump and his defenders a lot of ammunition in the great national game of whataboutery, enabling them to deflect questions about their own race baiting by pointing to Young and her hiring by the New York Times. Even if Young lacked the power to inflict harm on white people, said David French in NationalReview.com, her words dripped with real hatred. In one tweet, she said, quote, "It's kind of sick how much joy I get out of being cruel to old white men," end quote. That is sick. And when anti-white sentiment is embedded in the New York Times editorial board, it's no longer powerless. The right has a point about Young, said Max Boot in WashingtonPost.com. But how can conservatives be so bothered by the tweets of a 30-year-old tech writer while shrugging off the far more prominent bigot in the Oval Office, ranting daily about blank hole countries, rapist Mexicans, and low IQ black celebrities? The left has a point as well, said Jonah Goldberg in NationalReview.com. For Young's conservative critics to claim her tweets are equivalent to the racism and oppression experienced by minorities in this country is absurd. But that doesn't mean anti-white racism is just fine. Making sweeping assumptions about a person based on his or her skin color is a practice that all Americans, liberal, conservative, and otherwise, should reject. Time for our good week, bad week segment. Let's see what we've got. It was a good week for not going gently after a pair of elderly men escaped from a German retirement home and were found at 3 a.m. enjoying the Wacken Heavy Metal Festival. This year's event featured Judas Priest, Running Wild, and Hatebreed. It was a good week for comebacks after former Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad emerged from obscurity to criticize President Trump for calling NBA star LeBron James stupid. In my opinion, everyone, especially a president, should love all. I love at King James. One especially a president should love all. I love at, in my opinion, everyone, especially a president, should love all. Ahmadinejad, 61, wrote on Twitter, which is banned in Iran. It was a good week for Charity for All after Ruth Reed of New Jersey gave money to a long-haired man who was a few dollars short at her local convenience store and told him he looked like country superstar Keith Urban. "I am Keith Urban," Keith Urban responded. But it was a bad week for subtraction after mathematician Kosher Bakar won the prestigious Fields Prize for his work on polynomial equations, only to have the 14-karat gold medal stolen by someone at the presentation ceremony in Rio de Janeiro. Bakar will receive a substitute medal. It was a bad week for authenticity after the makers of Almond Breeze recalled 150,000 half-gallon cartons of almond milk from 28 states because some were contaminated with actual cow's milk. And it was a bad week for really fake news after a report that when Jared Kushner owned the New York Observer, he secretly ordered a software engineer to delete stories critical of his wealthy friends from the paper's website. "Jared is such a coward," said the editor at the time, Elizabeth Spears. "He knew I wouldn't do it." And before we leave this page, let's take a boring but important item. Price rises for the border wall. President Trump wants $18 billion to build a wall along the 722 miles of the U.S.-Mexico border. But Congress lead watchdog now says the Trump administration has underestimated the project's cost by billions of dollars. The Government Accountability Office found that the agency tasked with the construction project failed to consider how land ownership and terrain would affect the cost, as it rushed planning at the president's urging. Funding for the wall must come from Congress, and Trump has threatened a government shutdown in September if he doesn't get it. Democrats said the GAO report proved the wall isn't a serious policy proposal. "This administration has no clue what it's doing," said Representative Benny Thompson, Democrat from Mississippi. And here's a short Only in America note. Says that parents anxious about their children's social standing are now hiring tutors to improve their video game skills. Most tutors focus on Fortnite, the online shoot 'em up with 125 million global users, and charge up to $20 for a half-hour lesson. "It's really surreal to me," said tutor Logan Werner, 18. "My dad would never have paid for me to take video game lessons." And we will read a few items from the U.S. at a glance section this week. California, blazes keep spreading. Wildfires continued to tear through California this week, with one becoming the largest in state history. That fire, called the Mendocino Complex, was likely started by a spark from a hammer. It has scorched more than 450 square miles, forcing tens of thousands of people to evacuate. More than 13,000 firefighters are battling the blazes, along with 2,300 members of the National Guard and an Army infantry battalion. 17 states have sent help. "You cannot wait for the phone to ring here," said Mark Guliducci, who runs the command center near Sacramento. "You have to be in front of the next disaster." President Trump claimed that California is diverting vast amounts of water into the ocean that could be used to fight the fires. State officials said there was no shortage of water, and what has actually exacerbated the fires is warming from climate change. Mesa, Arizona. Migrant kids abused. A 25-year-old worker at a shelter for immigrant boys will stand trial later this month for molesting 8 children, ProPublica.org reported this week. The alleged crimes occurred at a facility run by Southwest Key, a federally funded nonprofit that houses more than 1,500 children in Arizona, California, and Texas, including some separated from their parents under zero-tolerance immigration policies. The Trump administration has touted these shelters' safety, but recently revealed cases suggest a history of abuse. Levian Pacheco is accused of performing oral sex on 2 teens and groping 6 others over an 11-month period beginning in 2016. Last month, a worker at Southwest Key in Phoenix was charged with abusing a 14-year-old girl. In 5 years, Southwest Key has received more than $1.3 billion in federal funds, including $500 million so far this year. New York City, Trump ally arrested. Representative Chris Collins, Republican from New York, the first member of Congress to endorse Trump's candidacy for president, was arrested this week on charges of insider trading. Collins is accused of telling his son, Cameron, to sell their shares of an Australian pharmaceutical company in June 2017, before the results of a failed drug trial became public, avoiding losses of more than $570,000. Collins' lawyer promised to mount a vigorous defense to clear his good name. According to the federal indictment, the CEO of Innate Immunotherapeutics sent an email to the company's board of directors, which included the senior Collins, explaining that the test of a drug designed to treat multiple sclerosis had failed. Minutes later, Collins called his son 6 times before they had a brief conversation. Over the next 4 days, the son sold more than 1 million shares of the company. Collins, who has represented the Buffalo area since 2013, has served as an informal liaison between the Trump administration and Congress. Chicago, bloody weekend. At least 74 people were shot last weekend in Chicago, making it one of the bloodiest stretches of the year in a city plagued by gun violence. 12 people died and no arrests have been made. The violence peaked in a 7-hour period Sunday morning when 41 people were shot, mostly on the city's west and south sides. That brings the year's tally to at least 300 homicides and 1,700 people shot, according to the Chicago Tribune. Shooters targeted block parties, a funeral, and other gatherings, in some cases firing indiscriminately into crowds. The largest attack wounded 8 people, including 3 teenage girls. It had seemed like the city was trending in the right direction, said Jans Ludwig of the University of Chicago's crime lab. But when you see this, anybody who lives in the city of Chicago is going to be concerned. And finally, in Washington, D.C., limiting immigration. The Trump administration is finalizing a proposal that would make it harder for legal immigrants who have received public benefits to become citizens or obtain green cards, NBCNews.com reported this week. The law already allows the government to block immigrants who are likely to burden government services. The proposed rules would expand that to penalize immigrants if they or members of their household have used any of a wide array of government programs, including food stamps, the Children's Health Insurance Program, some forms of Medicaid, and certain subsidies under the Affordable Care Act. Though the rules could affect more than 20 million immigrants and amount to the biggest change to legal immigration in decades, they would not require congressional approval to be put in effect. The proposal is said to be the work of Stephen Miller, the White House aide behind Trump's most polarizing immigration policies. And we'll go from the U.S. at a glance to the world at a glance. We'll start with Ciudad Juarez, Mexico. Forgive the cartels. Mexican president-elect Andres Manuel López Obrador is struggling to sell his drug war peace plan to the families of people murdered by the cartels. López Obrador, who takes office in December, is proposing to broker an amnesty deal with criminal organizations, similar to the peace plan in Colombia that gave amnesty to leftist FARC rebels who handed in their weapons. He kicked off a 3-month listening tour this week, talking to survivors in the northern border city of Ciudad Juarez about how to end the military-led drug war, which has killed some 200,000 people over the past 12 years. But when López Obrador told survivors, "I am in favor of forgiveness," the crowd shouted back, "Neither forgive nor forget." From Rome, anti-vax law. Italy's new populist government is pushing a bill that would remove mandatory vaccines for school children, even though the country has experienced a surge in measles cases. Legislation passed by the upper house of parliament last week suspends for a year the requirement that parents provide proof of 10 routine vaccinations when enrolling their children in school. The bill still needs to be passed by the lower house. The two coalition parties in power, the Five Star Movement and the Far Right League, both campaigned on skepticism about vaccines, which many Italians believe can cause children to develop autism. That link has been thoroughly debunked by scientists. Italy had 5,000 cases of measles last year, up from 870 in 2016, which led to 4 deaths. Brussels. Kids euthanized. Doctors in Belgium have killed at least 3 children by euthanasia in the past 2 years, according to a new government report. The 3 minors, ages 9, 11, and 17, were among 4,337 cases of euthanasia in the country in 2016 and 2017. Officials said the children all suffered from incurable terminal diseases and chose to end their lives with parental consent. Within Belgium, those particular cases haven't spurred much controversy. But other cases have, including several involving elderly patients who were non-terminal but in pain or distress. After a dementia patient who could not consent to euthanasia was given a lethal injection last year at the request of her family, 360 Belgian doctors and academics signed a petition demanding tighter regulations. Belgium extended the right to euthanasia to minors in 2014. It is the only country to do so. Boa Vista, Brazil. Venezuelans pour in. Brazil's border with Venezuela was briefly closed this week as the country struggles to cope with a massive influx of Venezuelans fleeing their nation's economic collapse. The governor of Brazil's Roraima state, Sule Campos, had asked for the closure, saying her already poor Amazon region couldn't provide adequate aid to the 500 Venezuelans who are arriving each day. Many Venezuelan families are now living on the streets of Roraima's state capital, Boa Vista, which has seen a surge in crime. A federal judge granted Campos' request, but the border was soon ordered reopened by the Supreme Court. Brazilian President Michel Temer said the federal government would use military planes to transport the refugees to other cities. It is not Brazil's way of doing things, closing borders, he said. This is from Moscow. Paul on a mission. Senator Rand Paul did a lot of diplomacy on what was billed as a private trip to Moscow this week. Paul delivered a letter from President Trump to Russian President Vladimir Putin, invited Russian lawmakers to visit Congress, and met with Russia's former ambassador to the U.S., Sergei Kislyak, a key player in the scandal surrounding Russian interference in the 2016 election. State Duma member Leonid Slutsky asked Paul to work for the release of Maria Butina, the accused Russian spy who forged ties with Republican operatives and the National Rifle Association. Those who believe in either country that we should not have diplomacy are greatly mistaken, Paul said of U.S.-Russia relations. Discussions are incredibly important. Tokyo. Women kept from med schools. Tokyo Medical University admitted this week it had been systematically falsifying results of women's entrance exams for nearly a decade, docking points and barring many from admittance. Unnamed sources told the Yomiuri Shimbun that officials didn't want to waste a medical education on women who would just get pregnant and quit the profession. In 2010, the incoming class was 40% women. This year, it was 18%, even though women made up 39% of the total applicants. We betrayed the public trust, said University Managing Director Tetsuo Yukioka. We want to sincerely apologize. Campaigners are now demanding to know whether other universities also rigged results against women. Riyadh. Fury at Canada. In a sign that it will no longer tolerate Western criticism, Saudi Arabia expelled the Canadian ambassador after his government urged Riyadh to free detained human rights campaigners. Following the arrest of two women's rights activists last week, Canadian Foreign Minister Chrystia Freeland called for the release of one of them, Samar Badawi, as well as her brother, Raif, a blogger imprisoned for criticizing Saudi Arabia's religious establishment. Riyadh responded by kicking out Canada's envoy, freezing new trade deals with Ottawa, and ordering the roughly 15,000 Saudi students in Canada to return home. The Saudi Central Bank is selling off its Canadian bonds. Canada won't apologize, though. Canada will always stand up for human rights, said Freeland. The Trump administration declined to take sides. On the briefing page, we have an article that refers back to that cover drawing titled, "The Russians Are Coming Again." Intelligence officials warn that Russia hasn't stopped interfering with U.S. elections. Are we still vulnerable? What are the Russians doing? The Kremlin is waging a coordinated campaign to influence and disrupt U.S. elections in order to create doubt about their legitimacy and further divide and weaken the country. Russian hackers have already been detected trying to infiltrate the computer systems of at least three congressional campaigns, including that of Senator Claire McCaskill of Missouri, one of the Senate's most vulnerable Democrats. The Russians also appear to be continuing to run influence and disinformation campaigns on social media, using fake online accounts designed to inflame America's political divisions. Facebook revealed last week that it has shut down at least 32 fake accounts with at least 300,000 followers. Intelligence officials have warned that the Russian government could also launch cyber attacks on the country's voting systems, which it began probing during its campaign to interfere in the 2016 election. These actions are persistent, they are pervasive, and they are meant to undermine America's democracy, said Dan Coats, the director of national intelligence. The warning lights are blinking red. Have election systems been made secure? No. America's outdated election infrastructure offers ample targets for hackers. 41 states use voter registration databases built more than a decade ago, with many vendors no longer tracking vulnerabilities or providing security updates. Hackers could potentially delete or change voter registration records, or simply shut down some machines in key precincts, creating chaos and doubt about the validity of results. Fully electronic voting machines, where no paper record is generated, are still used in 14 states. In April, J. Alex Halderman, a professor of computer science at the University of Michigan, demonstrated to the New York Times how to hack the AccuVote TSX, a paperless voting machine used in 10 states, to change the votes recorded on it. If we were criminals and weren't worried about going to jail, I think my undergraduate computer security class could have probably changed the 2016 result in Michigan, Halderman said. What happened in 2016? Russian hackers targeted 21 states' election systems during the election, including the battleground states of Florida, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Virginia, and Wisconsin. The hackers were able to penetrate voter registration data in several states, including Illinois, where they stole data on roughly 500,000 voters. There's no evidence that any records were deleted or changed, or that hackers were able to change actual vote tallies. But they were clearly probing weaknesses. How did the U.S. respond? The White House learned from the CIA in August 2016 that the Russian government was actively working to bolster Donald Trump's candidacy and hurt Hillary Clinton. But the Obama administration struggled to find ways to push back. Homeland Security Secretary Jeb Johnson warned that state election officials and offered federal assistance, but was rebuffed by Republican secretaries of state who saw it as federal encroachment. At a September 2016 summit, President Obama personally confronted Russian President Vladimir Putin, saying, "Cut it out," and warning that there would be consequences if Russia continued hacking. The White House also pushed for a bipartisan statement publicly condemning Moscow and urging states to accept federal cybersecurity assistance. But Republicans balked, with Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell reportedly expressing skepticism about the intelligence community's findings. The White House decided against further concrete action, out of fear it would be seen as a partisan attempt to embarrass Trump and throw the election to Clinton. "It is the hardest thing about my entire time in government to defend," a senior Obama administration official told the Washington Post last year. I feel like we sort of choked. What's been done since? After the election, the lame duck Obama administration designated election systems critical infrastructure, giving local election officials access to Homeland Security resources, usually reserved for hospitals, power plants, and financial institutions. So far, at least 33 states have asked for assistance in assessing voter registration systems. Congress approved $380 million in election security funding in March to help states upgrade their election infrastructure. But some states say it's not nearly enough. By way of contrast, Congress approved $3.6 billion in 2002 to help states replace the punch card voting machines at the center of the disputed 2000 election. What should be done? Election security experts say there are several basic steps needed to protect the vote. In an open letter to Congress, 103 computer scientists last year outlined a series of recommendations, including replacing all paperless voting machines, setting minimum security requirements for voter registration systems, and conducting post-election audits. Nonetheless, the Senate last week blocked $250 million in additional election security funding, and many states will not have the recommended defenses in place this November. If control of the House or Senate is decided by just a few seats, hackers could undermine the entire 2018 elections by casting doubt on the results in just a handful of races. "We know what to do," said cybersecurity analyst Bruce Schneier. "It's not a matter of figuring out the tech. The problem is our political system." Well, I'll read a few of the best columns of the week and then save a few and circle back next week. These first two come from the U.S. The era of downward mobility. It's an axiom among many Americans that each future generation will live better than its predecessor, said Robert Samuelson. But it's no longer true. For many young people with successful parents, there is downward mobility. Despite the strong economy, young people are struggling professionally and economically. As a result, they're delaying marriage and childbearing, living with their parents or getting financial help from them, and giving up on home ownership. Their parents, meanwhile, are suffering angst about their children's futures. A new study found that 90% of children born in 1940 ultimately exceeded their parents' incomes. But for those born in 1980, only 50% did. Among millennials, the trend line continues downward, especially among those who've come from the upper middle classes. The higher the parents' incomes, the less likely that their children's will match them. This is true even though these offspring have all the advantages, including good schooling and attentive parents. Upper middle class parents are thriving in this economy, but they know they are often judged by how well their children are doing. And the truth about how their kids are doing is not so great. Trump, Koch were destined to clash. President Trump and Republican megadonor Charles Koch were never more than allies of convenience, said Jim Garrity. And now they're headed for an angry divorce. Koch, who is worth about $50 billion, did not support either Trump or Hillary Clinton in the presidential race, likening it to a choice between cancer or a heart attack. He and his now retired brother, David, have always been more committed to free markets and other libertarian principles than the GOP itself, and were no doubt appalled when the Trump administration ran up a $1 trillion deficit and charged full speed ahead on tariffs and trade wars. As a result, the Koch donor network just announced it won't back Republican congressional candidates in the midterm elections who defend Trump's trade policies. That enraged Trump, who called the Kochs a total joke and their network highly overrated. Not so. 96% of all Kochbach candidates won their races in 2016. The network had pledged to spend $400 million to help Republicans keep control of Congress, but Koch is now warning he won't support Trump loyalists and may even back some Democrats. This split was probably inevitable, but it's still bad news for Republicans and for Trump. This comes from Germany. Should we get our own nukes? Germany can no longer count on the American nuclear shield, said Christian Hack. The resentful isolationism of U.S. President Donald Trump isn't some aberrant blip. It is a strong theme in much of U.S. history, most recently between the two world wars, and it is likely to persist. Germany, once America's close ally, is now seen as Trump's arch enemy. This sudden reversal couldn't come at a worse time. Russia and China are flexing their muscles while Germany's own armed forces are in a catastrophic state of neglect. Nothing flies, nothing floats, nothing runs. Germany then needs a nuclear deterrent, and fast. Some have argued that we could co-finance the French and British nuclear arsenals, but that seems unworkable, given that for 70 years Europe has tried and failed to come up with a common defense policy. Instead, Germany should have a sober conversation about building our own nuclear force. We need not wallow in hysteria or alarmism, but simply ask, under what conditions and at what cost could Europe's central power become a nuclear power? Would Western security be enhanced by such a transformation? We have failed to entertain this debate out of a lack of civil courage, but can no longer do so, because in a crisis, Germany can rely only on itself. This is from Nigeria. Our coast is littered with wrecks. Nigeria has become the world's dumping ground for old ships, said Yura Waino Warami. Environmental activist Prince David Omagomi says some 3,000 ships' hulks are rotting away in the waters off Nigeria's coast, harming the ocean environment and ravaging the ecosystem of mangrove swamps. The wrecks that wash up on shore cause erosion of waterfront villages. Decommissioned ships are supposed to be dismantled at a dockyard where their steel and other components can be recycled. But that costs money, so many ship owners collect the insurance payout for decommissioning and then just scuttle the wreck off of Nigeria. Omagomi is calling on the federal government to send the Navy out to patrol the coast and prevent unscrupulous foreigners from dumping the vessels. As an oil-producing nation, Nigeria already has an oil spill detection response agency to find and close pipeline breaches. The agency could be given the resources and mandate to search for and clean up spills offshore as well. The laws need to be amended. Fines need to be punitive and hefty, and they need to deter operators from destroying the environment, said Omagomi. Nigeria should no longer be ridiculed as the shipwreck graveyard of the world. Here's a short piece from the It Must Be True. I read it in the tabloids section. A Chinese man was hoping to save $3 on a car wash, ended up wrecking his $150,000 Land Rover after he drove the luxury SUV into a river. The man parked his four-wheel drive in what looked like a shallow river stream, hoping the flowing water would clean the car of some dirt. But then an upstream dam opened its floodgates, and the rushing water swept the vehicle away and left him stranded on an islet. Firefighters eventually rescued the driver and his flooded SUV. The car is absolutely clean now, one person joked on Chinese social media. On the poll watch, we have While 85% of Americans say that press freedom is critical for American democracy, 48% of Republicans agree with President Trump that the media are the enemy of the American people. 43% of Republicans say that Trump should have the authority to close news outlets engaged in bad behavior. Also on the poll watch, 56% of Americans say they believe in the God of the Bible, while 33% say they believe in some higher power or spiritual force. In one of our short notes, in the 145 school shootings committed by minors since 1999, the guns involved in at least 84 of them were taken from the shooter's home or from a friend's or family member's home. But in those cases, just four adults have been successfully prosecuted for failing to keep their guns secure. Terrorist attacks by Muslims received 357% more press coverage than terrorist attacks by white supremacists and other non-Muslims, a new study has found. And we will wind up today's program with a quote from G.K. Chesterton, quoted in DailyWire.com. He says, "Angels can fly because they take themselves lightly." And with that, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Please be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. If you have questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. It's 919-832-5138.